Have you got your little recorder as well? Yeah. Larry, you got your little recorder as well?
I do.
Okay, let's go. So, welcome back, everybody. This is the Yecheskel Shir, the Ulu Nishmosim Ephraim Shmuel ben Avraham Aryeh Cohen, Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel Cohen on the Book of Yecheskel. The Shir is also dedicated to all our soldiers, all our support staff, all our logistics, all our first responders, and everybody in the land of Israel and throughout the world that's supporting the Jewish people at this time. It's not a good time for the Jewish people. And we have Tzur Yisrael. We have the Rock of Israel behind us. So as long as we stay united, we are indestructible. And as long as we keep learning Torah and davening, we'll be safe, please God. And a special mention to the fact that we sit here in Anana in security to learn Torah, and a tremendous hakaras hatov to the army and to everyone else involved that guarantees our ability to sit here and learn Torah together. I'm just going to mute everybody,
Amen.
and we're going to begin. It's been a few weeks, so I'll tell you where we're up to. We're in chapter 13 of Yechezkel. We're up to verse 19. In the first part of chapter 13, we were discussing the false prophets of Israel, the male false prophets. In the last year, we started to discuss the ladies. There were ladies in Yerushalayim that were practicing some types of witchcraft, and some say they were charlatans, some say they actually had powers. We'll discuss that a little bit in more detail today. And what we're discussing, the last thing we discussed was the fact that they used these two methods of foretelling the future. They used to tie a pillow to the arms of their clients, and they used to put a shmata on their heads, and they used to foretell the future. And we discussed the fact that the Malbim says this is an indication that they were trying to use the power of the tefillin, that they used to put these ornaments on the customers' arms, in the place where the tefillin went, and on their heads where the tefillin shel rosh went. And that was the opinion of the Malbim. He brings Kabbalistic sources to support it. And that's where we got up to. And in verse 19, chapter 13, verse 19, we're told other things that these women, professionals, professional card readers and tea leaf readers and palm readers and all this type of nonsense, all the stuff that was going on in Yerushalayim towards the end of the first temple period. So it says in verse 19, Vatechalelena, Vatechalelena, Osi El Ami. God says, you have profaned me before my nation. The Sha'alei Se'orim, Uvivsosei Lechem, Lahonis Nefoshos Asher Ulachayos nefoshos asher lo sechayeno b'chazevchem la'ami shomei kozel. And you used, apart from the other things that you use fiscals of barley, which is shale se'orim, and pifsosei lechem, and pieces of bread, in order to kill souls, lachomis nefoshos asher lo semusena, that shouldn't die, and to sustain souls, to sustain people's lives, that shouldn't really be alive. You lied to my people, and the people were foolish enough to listen to your lies. And we started to discuss this verse last week or a few weeks ago. And what exactly is going on here? What's the trick with these morsels of bread? And we mentioned the Malbim last time. You can go back and we discuss this in great detail. But if you look at these women as total charlatans, like the women you see at the fairgrounds, reading the tea leaves and looking through the looking through
Crystal ball.
the crystal ball. Thank you very much. Yeah. Looking through the crystal balls and all this type of thing, If you look at these women as total charlatans, what's going on here is that these women, apart from the tricks that they did use in the props that we talked about before, and based obviously on how much you paid them, which they did using these schmatters that they put on the arms and the veils that they put on the people's head, the more you paid them, the more positive that their prophecy was. But what this pasuk is telling you, what this verse is telling you, is apart from that trick, they had another trick. And as God outlines, just go through the words of the pasuk, these women further profaned God's name. How is that? They gave you an added service at the end of your prophecy for a few extra bucks. They'd read like the tea leaves. They'd read like you bring them the bread from your breakfast table, and they'd have a read of it. They'd read the grains of barley and the pieces of bread that were left over for your breakfast. And if you paid them enough, lahomis nefasha sashelus musena, the woman would tell the customer that she could arrange for people that the customer didn't like to die early. And ulachayos nefashos ashelos sechiena, and or arrange for people they liked to have an extended life. Like if you got an enemy, they could arrange them to die early. And if you got a friend who's sick, they could arrange for them to survive, which was a great subsidiary or auxiliary service that they provided, to which God says at the end of the verse, Bekazevchem la'ami shomei kozel. You delivered blatant lies and nonsensical predictions to my people, and they're foolish enough to believe your irrational and ridiculous forecasts. So that's where we got up to last time. But there's another opinion. There's a Gemara in Eiruvin, right in the middle of Eiruvin. Anyone that's learned Eiruvin knows that Gemara Eiruvin is very, very difficult to understand, particularly the halakhic sections of Eiruvin, very, very difficult. But just as difficult are the Agadic stories that we find in Eiruvin. And there is a Gemara there that describes the Shalei Seorim Upisosei Lechem. The fistfuls of barley and the morsels of bread that are described in this verse have actually got nothing to do with what the customers paid these women as fees. Rather, like the pillows and the shmatas that these women place on the arms of their clients and the veils and scarves they placed on their heads, the fistful of barley and morsels of bread mentioned in this verse were also props and part of either a pagan or a black magic, some type of pagan ritual, a Avodah Zarah ritual. And the Gemara in Eiruvin on Daf Samach Dalad on page 64, on Samach Dalad on the base, on the second Omad of Eiruvin, says as follows. Amar, what did we say before? The Gemara is discussing something that it mentioned earlier on. One of our lochas, there was a story there in the Gemara, which we're not going to go into because it doesn't really concern us. There was a story there involving Rabban Gamliel. He was walking on the road, and the question arose, is food on the road? Are you supposed to pick it up, or can you leave food on the road? But so the Gemara says, regarding the halacha that we just learned in the Gemara, you're not supposed to leave food lying in the street. And the Gemara there is discussing the idea that one must treat food with the respect it deserves. It's min hashamayim food, and you're supposed to pick it up. That's what you've ein ma'avir na la'ochlin. You're not supposed to leave food in the street. And on that, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yochanan mishum Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Rav Yochanan says in the name of the great Rav Shimon bar Yochai, lo shonu ela b'doros harishonim. This halacha, that you're supposed to, if you see food lying in the road, lying in the street, you're supposed to pick it up. This halacha applies only in the early generations. Going back to the time of Yeshua, through the first 600-700 years of the Jews establishing their status in the land of Israel, when Jewish women were not accustomed to using witchcraft. She'ein benos Yisrael prutzos b'kshofim. During the first 600 or 700 years, around the year 1278 BCE or 1273 BCE, for the first 600 years, Jewish women were not involved in kshofim. were not involved in witchcraft. Abel Bedoros Acharonim, says the Gemara, but in the later generations, at the end of the first temple period, Shabonis Yisrael Perutzos Bekshofim Mavirin, where during the, towards the end of the first temple period, when Jewish women were accustomed to using witchcraft, you're allowed to pass food. If you see food lying on the floor in the street, you're allowed to pass it over. You don't have to pick it up because it might have been used because of this possum. It might have been used for some type of witchcraft, some type of avodah zorah, and a person must not put himself in either unnecessary danger or because the bread might have been used in a pagan ritual, whatever the reason. If it's been used for avodah zorah, you're not allowed to pick it up. So that was the rule, towards the end of the first temple period, if you saw bread in the street when there were these witchcraft machers, these women, you could leave the food lying in the street. And the Gemara says, Tanah, Shleimin Marvirin. The Gemara brings another brisa, brings another Tanaic text. Shleimin Marvirin. If the loaves of bread are whole, Marvirin, one may ignore them in the street because they might have been placed there for the purpose of witchcraft. Pesisin Ein Marvirin. However, if they are in pieces, Ein Marvirin, you have to pick them up. Because you can be sure they were not used for witchcraft, to which this is what concerns us. And Omalei Ravasi La Ravashi, Ravasi, the late Amora, said to Ravashi, who was the redactor of the whole of the Gemara, but Afsisinlo Ovdon, is it really true that they didn't perform magic with pieces of bread? V'hoksiv v'tachalelno osi al ami b'shalei se'orim u'b'sosei lechem. Quoting our pasuk, that's exactly what the women did. That the women used to use pieces of bread and leftover barley, which is generally animal food, to predict the future. And so the Gemara says in the name of Rashi and Ravashi that if you see at the end of the first temple period, even if you see pieces of bread that are cut up, old pieces of bread, you know, you have to leave them alone. You can't pick them up. You're not allowed to pick them up. And because these were used in some type of pagan ritual, some type of, according to most opinions, it's charlatanism, if that's such a word. Nevertheless, that's what they used to do. That's what these women would do. They had various tricks. As we said, they use these things that they attach to people's arms and to people's heads, and they read the pieces of bread that people had, and that's why the Gemara in Erevin is very sharp in this idea that certainly at the end of the Second Temple period, it doesn't apply today, obviously. If you see food in the street, the locker is, you should pick it up. You shouldn't allow food to be in the street. You should pick it up. If it's ruined, you should put it in some type of bin or something like that, but you shouldn't leave food in the street. But at the time towards the end of the first temple period, you weren't allowed, the halacha was, you weren't allowed to pick up the pieces of bread because they were used for avodah zorah. And the halacha is, you can't have any benefit, you're not even allowed, a Jew isn't allowed, even allowed, halacha lemaisa, isn't even allowed to pick up something that has been used for avodah zorah. If you see a cross in the street made out of gold or a Buddha or something like that, you're not allowed to pick it up. And this is a deraisa, actually. It's a biblical prohibition to even to pick it up. So that's what these things were being used for at the time of the first temple. Just a footnote on this, that it seems that the power to divine magic is more prominent, is more potent in women than in men. Because if we look at the first part of this chapter, chapter 13, when dealing with men, Yechezkel and God are really dealing with false prophets. We went through that in great detail. And when it comes to dealing with the women don't seem to be false prophets. The women seem to be kishuf machers. They seem to be witchcraft workers. They work in sorcery and black magic and kishuf and all this type of thing. And it seems very strange that divine magic or black magic or all this type of sorcery is more prominent, more potent in women than in men. Interestingly, the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Samach Zayin on page 67 actually mentions the pasuk. When the pasuk, the Torah is discussing in Shemos, in chapter 22 of Shemos, when the Torah is there discussing the arts of the dark arts, the Harry Potter arts of black magic, it actually says, "Machashefa lo sechaya," you shall not allow a witch to live, and it uses the feminine. The Torah actually refers to the sorcerer, the purveyor of black magic, in the feminine. Now, obviously, the Issa D'Oraisa, the biblical commandment of not allowing a witch to live, and the fact that they've got to be executed, does not refer only to female who practices sorcery, but rather to both men and women practitioners as well. They're also included in the punishment. But it's very strange, as the Gemara points out, that the verse actually states a witch using the feminine form. And it does appear from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. This is because women are more familiar, have a greater ability, greater sensitivity to the art of witchcraft than men. And why should that be? And so in that Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Ben Yoyada, the Ben Ishchai, explains why the Gemara says that women have got a greater sensitivity to what he calls the koach hatumah, the power of the impure, like sorcery. They've got more readily, women can access the dark arts, so to speak, more readily than men. And he writes as follows. These are his words, and let's not take them. We take them seriously because they come from the Ben Yoyada. So he writes as follows. He says, since women, unlike men, spend much of their lives in a state of tumah, in a state of impurity, after all, during their menstrual cycle, they spend many days of the month in a state of tumah, in a state of impurity, unlike men. As a consequence, their bodies and souls become very sensitive to the effects and the reality of what tumah and impurity actually entails, giving them a unique perspective on how to access the powers of tumah. The power. Now, we don't see tumah as something tangible. It's something that's intangible. It's something that's abstract. But it seems to be what the Ben Yoyada is saying is that the more time you spend being tomei, the more sensitive you are to the power of tumah, to the power of being tomei. And what's interesting is that, maybe I won't say it, but what's interesting is that in Parashas Tazria, we're told that when a woman gives birth to a child, so after a certain amount of time, depending on whether she has a boy or a girl, she has to bring korbanos, she has to bring offerings to the temple. And she has to bring a chatos as well. One of the offerings she brings is a chatos, a sin offering. And it's very strange. Why would she have to bring a sin offering? Why would she have to bring an offering at all? But certainly, why would she have to bring a sin offering? After all, having a child is the first mitzvah in the Torah, right? Peru Ravu, it's a great mitzvah. And the Kotzka there, the Kotzka Rav, Rabbi Nachum Mendel of Kotzk, says that when a child is born, so there are three partners in the creation of a child. There's the father, there's the mother, and there's God. And when the child is born, so God leaves the scene. God's done his bit, and he leaves the scene. But when God leaves the scene, it's not a neutral leaving. Like, God's either here, which is a state of tahor, which is a state of purity, and God's not here. That's a state of tumah. There's no neutral area where something either is either not tomei or, sorry, not tahor or not tomei. There's no like purgatory area between tahara, between purity and tumah, which is impurity. If God's present, everything is tahor. If God's not present, everything becomes tomei. And he says that's why a woman has to bring a chatos. Because she's the cause for God to leave, so to speak, the scene of the mitzvah. And as a result of God leaving, the gap that's left behind, the neutral area that's left behind, not only is it not tahor, but it actually becomes tomei. And I think this is what the Ben Yoyada is getting at here. that there's a sensitivity in women to tumah that men don't have. Men very rarely become tummy. So that is God's take on these women. And now, in verse 20, God tells these women what will become of them and their magic towards the end of the first temple period. He says as follows, Lochay, verse 20, Lochay koama Hashem alakim, koama Hashem alakim, hinani el kususo sech, kiso seichena, asher atena mitzododos shom, esanafoshos leporchos. God says, I'm against your cushions. That's the word, kiso seichena. The cushions which you asher atena mitzdodosham esanafoshos leporchos, which you ensnare, you hunt souls, causing them to fly away from me. Bekarati osam, I will tear them off your me'ad zorosechem, I will tear them from your arms. Vishilachti esanafoshos asher atem mitzdodos, and I will send this people whose souls you hunt, es nefoshim leporchos. Yeah, the souls that you hunt, leporchos, to fly away. So, yeah, this is a very long-winded verse. Exactly what does it mean? So the Abba Rabanel explains what's going on. God's speaking to these witches, and you can take it or leave it. What are they? Are they charlatans, or did they actually have power? Some of them probably did. This is a power which we'll discuss a bit later on, but some of them were obviously charlatans, some of them were actually purveyors of black magic. So the Abba Rabanel says, Ani avatel kol ma'aseichem v'tachbulo seichem v'ateinus kususichno shebahem atein mitzodidus nafoshi kamashikos l'mala atenus on the prophets. God addresses these witches. He says, I will terminate all your tricks, all your magic, and take the cushions, the pillows with which you ensnare and hunt people's souls, and I'll throw them into leporchos. I'll throw them into the air like trash. Well, lefisha are you somim or some I'll call atzile yodayim, and as these women, they would put these pillows, these cushions on the elbows and the arms of their clients, their victims. God says, v'korati osam me'alzroseichem. God says, I'll tear them off their arms. And dispatch vishilachti esanafoshos, and I will dispatch their souls. What does it mean? I will dispatch their souls. It says the Abba Rabanel, Rotzalom ishet techorev Yushalayim, that when Yushalayim is finally destroyed by the Babylonians, vishbatu kol osma tachpulos, and all those tricks and lies that you have been telling your clients and building up your cash reserves, you'll be found out to be dishonest. Aksovim, all the lies you tell. Everything that you have said will be like trash in the air. And they will be torn to shreds as if they never existed. And further, God says, I'll send the souls that you hunt with your lies. I will dispatch these souls. Ashaleach, v'remez lekashedim ki'ilu yifruchu miyushalayim v'yelchu lebovel remez lekasdim ki'ilu yifruchu miyushalayim v'yelchu lebovel. God says, all these the souls of your clients and the victims of your victims of all the black magic, they'll all be either killed or they'll all be in exile so quickly, you know, like porchos, that it will be as if they've been carried there on the wind. Now, that's a very straightforward way of understanding this verse, but there's a very strange word in this verse that needs explaining. God says what will become of the souls of these witches and their clients that were ensnared with this black magic or the charlatan practices of these women. And he says, Vishilachti es anafoshos asher tem metzodados es nefoshim leporchos. God says, I will send these people whose souls you witches hunt to make them, I'll make them fly away. He's talking about them flying away. They'll be killed. They'll be in exile together with these witches. But God uses this word, nephoshim. Now, the word nephoshim is a very strange word because the plural word for nephesh is nephoshos. It's feminine. And the word nephoshim occurs nowhere else in Tanakh. Nowhere else. It's one of those words that occurs only once in Tanakh. Nephoshim, you can look it up in the concordance, which is what I did to make sure that that was right. This word nephoshim doesn't occur anywhere else. And it's very unusual that the souls, the word, the plural for souls for nephesh should be in, well, very unusual. It's unique that the word for souls should be in the masculine. And of course, the Malbim is hot on the heels of any strange word. He's a brilliant grammarian. Is that the right word? I don't know if that's the right word. But one of the things that he does in his Peirush throughout Tanakh is give you an insight into synonyms and similes in Hebrew. There are none. Every word's got its own conceptual basis. And certainly he says the word nephoshim here is a peculiar word. So he tells you what it means. He says, V'shilachti es nephosha she'atem metzodados es nephoshim neporchos. He says, Rotzalom isha etein metzodidim nephoshas biyad nephoshim Rotzalom b'shus kochos hatuma. All those fools that believed and trusted these witches and were conned into wearing those ridiculous cushions and pillows on their arms for protection. And God will send all these people and these sorceresses into the hands of the nephoshim. Now, the nephoshim are the unholy souls, the demons, the shadim, the mazikim that are present in the ether. That's the midah keneged midah. Nephoshim, he says, is a word that describes souls that are not human souls. These are souls that are created are around us all the time. We're lucky we can't see them because the Gemara in Brachos says that if we could see them, we'd be running for our lives. We'd all end up in lunatic asylums. So there are these nephoshim. There are these types of souls that were created. Some of them are purely spiritual. Some of them, the Shadim, for example, Shindalids, they're partially physical and partially spiritual. And the good news is we don't see them. But the Midah Keneged Midah here is that when these people, when these sorceresses die, God says that V'shilachti es nefoshes she'atem metzodos es nefoshem leparochos, that the souls of these sorceresses will be handed over to these demons, to these shadim, to these mazikim, different types of spiritual beings for retribution. That's where they'll get their true recompense for practicing black magic. And that's the word nefoshim. It's interesting that just mention that, or maybe not, I don't know. Go a bit deeper into the word nephoshim. Maybe we'll do that a little bit later on. That's the Malbim's opinion of the word nephoshim. And again, it's a word that doesn't occur again in Tanakh. So we can't be absolutely sure that's right. In fact, Ibn Ezra, he's got a more sanitized, rational view. Ibn Ezra is a rationalist. He's got a more sanitized, rational view of this strange word nephoshim, based on a pasuk in Vayikra. Now, the pasuk in Vayikra in chapter 20 Vayikra is discussing particular types of black magic, sorcery that was prevalent at the time of the destruction of the first temple. And the Torah says, "Va'nefesh asher tifne el ha'ovos el ha'yidonim," and the person who turns to an ov or a yidoni, which are two different types of witches, lizno zacharehem, to stray after them, v'nosati esponai b'nefesh ahi, I will set my attention, says God, on that person, v'hichrati oso mikerev amo, and I will cut him off from amongst his people. And the Ibn Ezra says there, the pasuk says there, v'nefesh asher tifne el ha'ovos v'el ha'yidonim, person who turns to an ov or a yidoni, which is two different categories of witches, an oath. Just to give you a brief outline description, an oath is someone, a balas oath. Again, it's always described as in the feminine. In the posik, it says ho'ovos in the feminine. A balas oath is someone that sums up the dead in a particular manner, and a yidoni does the same thing using the bones of dead birds. We don't need to get into, a practical demonstration of how it's done. But those are two methods of summoning up the dead. Ibn Ezra says here that these types of witches will be cut off. And the Ibn Ezra says this means that God will cut off, annihilate. Vihichrati, the word vihichrati means to be annihilated, both in this world and the next. God will cut off anyone who gives his children to Molech, which is to be burned alive, or to any of these witches. We've got an alarm, we've got the what's called overhead. I'm fortunately sitting in a mamad at the moment. We've got the I'll pause for a few minutes because we've got the alarms going overhead. There are missiles overhead as we sit and learn. So I'll just hold my peace for a second while we just heard the first missile explode over the top here. And I know a few people have left their places. So I'll just pause until the air raid siren goes off, and then I'll continue. Hamas doesn't like us to learn Torah. There are people here. Yeah, Boruch's gone. I can see Boruch's gone to his mamad, to his safe room. Mark May's sitting there, cozy. Joan Roth has gone to it. Larry's gone to his.
I think maybe Mark didn't hear the sirens because he's wearing those things on his ears.
Maybe. But Mark, Hamas doesn't frighten Mark May, I can tell you that. Nothing frightens Mark May. Nothing's going to frighten Mark May.
Harry, while we're on a pause, and your grammar saying Nefashim is male, male plural, why does it say Atem Metzodot? Why does it say Aten Metzodot?
We can't be too picky with the Tanakh. The Atem and Aten is, the word Aten is very rarely used. Very rarely used. The word loch and lachar, it's almost as if the rules of grammar in certain books of Tanakh, the laws of grammar go out the window. You see it in rabbinic texts as well. I mean, you see it in the Tshuvas of the Rama. Ramosha Isalis, he mixes up his masculine and feminine. He was told about it, and he says, I don't really care. I just want to get my message across. He says, as long as you understand what I'm saying. And it does appear that the word, again, osom, oson, itoch, itcha, even in the Torah, it sometimes is, it's not deliberately mixed up. It's, it can be taken both ways in biblical Hebrew. So, okay, so the air raid is over, and I'll just tell you what the Ibn Ezra says here. He says we find the term nefashim in Yechezkel, he said the word nefashim is masculine. Nefesh, a soul, is usually feminine. However, in all the pasuk that I just read to you from the Torah from Vayikra, so the Ibn Ezra says here, our verse in Vayikra when referring to witches It says, "V'hichrati, O soul, and I will eliminate him." He said this verse, therefore, this is probably something that you didn't pick up on, David Barrett, but you could have picked it up on when I mentioned the verse in Vayikra, that the verse in Vayikra reads, I'll just read it again to you, Nefesh asher tifnel obos v'al yidonim, a person who turns to these witches, liznos acharehem, to stray after them, and osati es panai benefesh hahi, in the feminine, hanefesh hahi, in the feminine, v'ichrati oso, and I will cut him off, masculine. So it nefeshahi feminine and vehichrat nefeshahi that soul feminine vehichrati oso, and I will cut him off masculine. So the Ibn Ezra says, look, it doesn't really matter. Nefoshos nefoshim. The word nefesh can be masculine. The word nefesh can be feminine. It can be used in both senses in the Tanakh. And he also quotes a pasuk from Bereishis, right at the end of Bereishis, where it's talking about the children of Rochel. The pasuk says, "Ela b'nei Rochel, asher yulad liYaakov." These are the sons, including the grandsons of Rochel, that were born to Yaakov. Called nefesh, all the souls were arba asar, 14, which was Binyamin and his 10 sons, Yosef and his 2 sons. That's 14. But the words arba asar is masculine, and the word nefesh is feminine. So he says, Eila b'nei Rochel, these are the sons and grandchildren of Rochel, asher yulad Yaakov, that were born to Yaakov. Kol nefesh, all the souls, feminine, arba asar, 14, masculine. So he said, the Torah treats the word nefesh as a masculine in that case. And as a result of that, we don't have to be too concerned that the word nefesh is actually feminine. It can be used in both senses. And therefore, when it's used in Yecheskel here as nefoshim in masculine plural, we don't need to be too worried about it, because the word nefesh itself isn't really feminine. It's just used mostly in feminine terms. And as a result of that, the word nefesh isn't really feminine anyway. And therefore, nefoshos and the word nefoshim are both applicable, even though the word nefoshim only occurs once in the whole of Tanakh. That's a rational approach. It's the rational approach of the Ibn Ezra. In the meantime, in verse 21, God continues his diatribe in his condemnation of these witches. He's told them what will become of them. If we take the words of the Malbim seriously, they're heading for, Midah Keneged Midah. They've been using sorcery to commit a biblical prohibition that carries with it the death penalty. And as a result of that, they'll be handed over to the people, these angels, these demons, these shadim, these mazikim, as a punishment. And coming up in the next verse, you'll notice, David Barrett particularly will notice, again, there's a to and fro with the masculine and the feminine right at the end of the next verse. But now God continues his condemnation and his diatribe against these witches, these ladies. He's told them what will become of their cushions, their pillows, placed on the arms of their clients. And now he tells them what's going to become of the veils and the scarves they put on the heads of their clients as well. And again, you'll notice here that the posuk drifts between masculine and feminine, which again will fit in with the way the Ibn Ezra will understand it. He says, God says, this is verse 21, "V'korati esmis b'choseichem, I will tear off your veils, v'hitzalti es ami miyedchem, I will save my people from your hands, miyedchen." Again, you see it in the feminine. "Below ye you owed beyedchen lemetsuda, and there will no longer be in your hands to be hunted, my people, vidaten ki ane Hashem." Again, vidaten in the feminine, and then you will know that I am God. So similarly, the similar message to the witches here that use these veils and scarves that I mentioned earlier, which I mentioned in the previous year, the Malbim says this, that they use these veils and scarves that they put on the heads of their clients in the place where the tefillin went. It creates some type of spiritual bond between the soul and the spiritual world. Exactly how it works, I don't want to know. I don't know, and I don't want to know. But that's what they used to use, these veils and scarves for sorcery. They'll suffer a similar fate. For Korati es misbechoseichem, says God. They'll suffer a similar fate to the other witches that use the cushions and pillows. God says that these women will have their magical veils and scarves ripped from them by the Babylonians and put in the trash. V'hitzalti es ami miyedchen. And then God says, and although the Jews that believed in these women will suffer greatly, at least their souls will be saved. Now, that's what it means, v'hitzalti es ami. Not that they'll be saved physically, because the majority of them will either be killed in Yerushalayim or they'll be sent into exile. But v'hisalti es ami miyedchem means their souls will be saved, unlike these women who are heading to Gehenna, which is the word Rashi uses here. That's where these women are heading. They're heading to Gehenna, very similar to the language of the Malbim. Below ye you owed v'yedchem l'tzuda, and this type of sorcery, black magic, will then be removed. And this is a statement of fact from God. This type of sorcery and black magic will then be removed forever from the Jewish psyche, which is one of the only pluses to come out of the Babylonian exile, which was the end of the Jewish people's belief in Avodah Zorah and the use of witches and black magic after they returned to the land of Israel. The 70-year, well, it's actually an 89-year exile in Babylonia, cured them of paganism. And it cured them of their lust to listen to witches and pursue black magic. It was never a factor in Jewish history after the return, the Shibat Sion, when Ezra and Zerubbabel brought the Jews back and rebuilt the Second Temple. There was never again, right up to this day, a problem with black magic, with Jewish people going to, or Jewish sorceresses. That was the end of it. And as I said, there was a huge Baal Teshuva movement in Babylonia, and one of the things they excised from the Jewish psyche, which thank God has never returned, was the idea of paganism and the idea of black magic and sorcery. That never came back with them from Babylonia. And finally, God says, Vidaten ki ani Hashem. Finally, the Jews and these women will realize too late for the women that God's running the show here, and nothing a witch can do or say can interfere with God's will and God's anger. And they won't prevent the massacres in Yerushalayim, and they won't save lives, and they won't extend lives. And whatever they say, so God didn't pay very much attention to that. And again, Vidaten ki ani Hashem. That's one of the good things that came out of the exile, is the fact that these Jews never, that the Jewish people never again resorted to this type of behavior. We don't hear of Jewish witches and sorceresses after this period in Jewish history. Now God, in verse 22, God describes the problems that the false prophets and these witches, the men and the women, that they all caused in Yerushalayim. He says, Yan hachos leiv tzadik sheker, because you discourage the heart of the righteous with lies, but ani lo hichavtiv ulchazek yidei rosha. And I, God, didn't discourage him. Didn't discourage him, and I didn't discourage it. Levilti shuv midarko haro lachiosa, and you strengthen the hands of lachazek yidei rosha. You strengthen the hands of the wicked people. Levilti shuv midarko, preventing them from repenting their evil ways. Lachiosa, so that they should live. So So what's exactly God saying here? Yan hacha'os leiv tzadik sheker, because you discourage the heart of the righteous with falsehood. What he's saying here, what God's saying here, what Yechezkel is saying here, is the constant bombardment. We have to understand that what Yerushalayim was like in the last 2 or 3 years before the Babylonians destroyed it, there was a constant bombardment of false prophecy and witchcraft that pervaded Yerushalayim at this time, and it had a tremendously depressing effect on the few righteous people that actually lived in Yerushalayim. Now remember, the biggest problem with the religious, righteous Jewish people in Yerushalayim is they never spoke out. They never challenged the words of the false prophets. They never challenged the words of these women. God says, Yan hacha'os leiv tzadik, the constant bombardment of false prophecy that pervaded Yerushalayim at this time had a tremendously depressing effect on the righteous. And that the message of these false prophets and these witches were so pervasive, that's the reason why the righteous people felt unable to speak out against them. And the reason is because as soon as they did so, the false prophet or witch would predict the death of anyone who spoke out against them, which of course has a knock-on effect that inhibited righteous people from speaking out and encouraging people to do teshuva, fearing their own death if they did so. And this caused tremendous despondency among the righteous, who felt they were trapped and had to keep a low profile. So as soon as anyone spoke out in Yerushalayim against the false prophets or against these witches, so they put a curse on them. And people were frightened. Naturally, people were frightened. And then the Pasuk says, "V'ani lo hich avti." God makes a confession here. I, God, didn't discourage it. I didn't discourage him, and I didn't discourage it. In essence, God's saying, look, I don't interfere with free will decisions of man. This is a very, very strange statement to God. I didn't discourage him, the false prophet, and I didn't discourage it. I didn't discourage what was going on in Yerushalayim. I could have interfered, but I didn't. I don't interfere, says God. I don't interfere with the free will decisions of men. Obviously, there are exceptions to it, but God, under normal circumstances, will not interfere with the free will decisions of man. That is one of the powers that he abrogated after the sin in the Garden of Eden. Consequently, God says, when the false prophets and these witches would predict the death of anyone who spoke out against them, it was up to the individual to make the calculation whether these people were telling the truth, and that whether righteous people were truly risking their lives by speaking out, or whether to recognize that these false prophets and sorceresses and witches were speaking nonsense, and that they were not speaking in God's name, and that people should ignore the words of these charlatans and actually speak out. Now, the truth is that we learned before in earlier chapters that the righteous people didn't speak out. They kept silent, and that's one of the reasons that they were caught up in the calamity and the massacres that took place in Yerushalayim. Now, it could be that the reasons why they never spoke up is because they were frightened. They were frightened about the powers that these women had, or the powers that these false prophets had, and therefore they kept a low profile. But as a result of that, that didn't help them. They were like between a rock and a hard place. If they figured to themselves, if they spoke up, the witches or the false prophets would kill them. And if they didn't speak up, they were in danger because God would blame them for not speaking up. So they were in a little bit of between a rock and a hard place. And God says, "L'chazik yidei rosha," and you strengthen the hands of the wicked one. And the corollary of the righteous people being sidelined and scared to speak out against these false prophets and witches was that the evil people of Yerushalayim were encouraged by the lies of the false prophets and the witches, because they see that the righteous people in Yerushalayim didn't say anything. And when the false prophets gave their false prophecy, and when these witches were practicing their witchcraft, the righteous never said anything. And that just encouraged the populace to get involved with false prophecy, to believe it, to use these sorceresses, the Baalis Ob and the Yidonim, because they wanted to believe the words of the false prophets, and they wanted to believe the words of the witches, because their message was an optimistic message. The words of the false prophets, the words of the charlatans, the words of these women preached, was that the lifestyle that the wicked people of Yerushalayim had adopted, which was Avodah Zorah and sexual perversions and corruptions, was fine. It was appropriate. And not only that, they also passed on the message that the Babylonians would never break through and conquer the city, and they'd continue to live in peace. And they were encouraged by the silence of the from Jews of Yerushalayim, cowed, frightened to speak out for fear of becoming victims of these witches or these false prophets. It just encouraged the wicked to continue their evil path. And that's why God says here, L'chazek yidei rosha, because of the silence of the righteous, everybody else was encouraged to believe the words of the false prophets. So they carried on with their Avodah Zorah, their paganism, they carried on with their sexual perversions, believing the words of the false prophets that that the Babylonians would never conquer. God would never allow it. God would never allow his city to be attacked and burnt down. And they were encouraged by the silence of the righteous. And finally, in the Pasuk says, Levil tishuv midar kohara lachiosa. And that prevented the wicked, the knock-on effect of that is it prevented the wicked person from ever repenting, from ever doing teshuva, so that he could have a chance to save his own life. So this is like a sorry downhill spiral. Like the upshot of this whole sorry episode was that the words of these false prophets prevented any attempt by the righteous to speak out against these false claims, these false prophecies, and these divinations, as they were required to do. And at the same time, it encouraged the perpetuation of a morally corrupt society that was really the epitome of the Middle East, the center of a corrupt, morally corrupt society. If you had to pick a place in the Middle East at the time of the destruction of the First Temple, you'd pick Yerushalayim. And there you have it. That's the downhill spiral. The righteous didn't speak up. The people were encouraged by that. The more they're encouraged by that, the more they believed the words of the false prophets, the more they believed that God would never destroy Yerushalayim, and the more the bigger the hole that they were eventually digging themselves into, that would all end in tears. Just a footnote here, the difference between male false prophets and women witches. I just want to mention that. I'll deal with that. That's the final thing I'll deal with, and we'll start at verse 23 next time. There's a big difference between the male false prophets and the women witches, the female witches. The male false prophets, these men were preaching on a macro level. They were addressing the whole nation. They were addressing the country of Yehuda, and they were addressing the people of Yerushalayim. Their message was, you people shouldn't listen to the real prophets, because their message is well past its sell-by date. When you hear from people like Yechezkel or Yirmiyahu, or you're reading the prophecies of Yeshayahu or Hosea, all these messages that these prophets have been giving you, they're giving you the same dark message of destruction and exile for hundreds of years. It hasn't happened yet, and it's never going to happen. Carry on with your lifestyle. Your lifestyle choices are your own, and there are going to be no consequences. The Babylonians will never defeat you. After all, would God, the rhetorical question that they asked, the false prophets asked the populace, would God allow his city, his temple, to be destroyed? And of course, the righteous people of Yerushalayim should have spoken out, but they didn't. And as a result of their silence, they were punished, killed, exiled with the rest of the population. But the false prophets were speaking on a macro level. They were speaking to the people as a whole. They were standing on the soapboxes. They were speaking in the shuls. they were speaking outside the Beis HaMikdash to the general population. The female witches, on the other hand, were preaching on a micro level. They were advising and prophesying for the individuals. Anyone with questions about their personal life, about their friends or their enemies, would go to these women for advice. And as long as you had enough cash, you'd get the optimistic advice, the prediction, prophecy that you wanted to hear. It's amazing the human propensity, to accept a message you really do want to hear, to be very happy when somebody tells you something that you want to hear, and it's very easy to believe it. They would go to these women on an individual basis, and they'd tell them, this is in the Zohar here, I don't want to go into it in too much detail, but they'll tell people that so-and-so will die, but you'll have a long, affluent life. Your alternate lifestyle is perfectly fine. Pay no attention to those who call you immoral. There's no such thing as immorality, which is, this is in the Zohar. This is, you know, and this is what was going on in Yerushalayim 2,450 years ago. So, fast forward 2,450 years, and guess what? This is the world we live in now. Alternative lifestyles are perfectly fine. Pay no attention to those that call you immoral. There's no such thing as immorality. Well, that's the message that these women were passing to their clients 2,500 years ago. It's the same message that we're being force-fed now by the liberal woke left, that there's no such thing as immorality. But we know what happens when there's no such thing as immorality. Because these women were very popular, and as the Torah says, they actually did employ some sort of influence, some sort of power, some sort of koach hatumah, it was very hard for the righteous to speak out, fearing personal retribution from these women who could and would employ, so to speak, this koach hatumah, this power of tumah, which we don't see in the world today, to cause them harm. So that's the that is where we're up to, and we're up to the point where God gives His we're up to the last verse in chapter 13, where God gives His final message to these women. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but as I said, there's a little bit more to say on this last verse. We haven't got time to do it now. I'll just read the verse and we'll discuss it next week. And then we'll move on to a very, very strange chapter, chapter 14. I'll just read God's final message to these women, these purveyors of black magic. Lochein, God says, therefore, Shav lo sechazeno, bekesem lo siksa samno. You shall neither prophesy nonsense nor use siksam no od. You'll not use any sorcery any longer. Behitzalti es ami miyedchen. I will save the souls of my people from your hands. Vidaten ki ene Hashem. And you will know that I am God. Now, the problem with this verse, verse 23, which is the last verse in the chapter, is it's a repetition of verse 21. Right? Which is basically an exact repetition of verse 21. So what on earth is it doing here? So that is what we'll have to tackle next time. But God says, like, at the end of the day, He's already told them that they're not going to succeed and they're all going to die, and those that don't die are going to exile, and they'll be handed over, their souls will be handed over to the Shadim, etc., etc. And now He's repeating it. Lochein shav lo sechazena. You shall neither prophesy nonsense, v'kesem lo siksam no'od. You won't use sorcery any longer. V'itzalti es ami miyedchen. Again, exactly the same language as verse 21. I will save the souls of my people from you. V'daten ki anei Hashem. And finally, of course, when it's too late, you'll recognize, you'll experience that I am God. So why is there a need to repeat this verse? Please, God, we'll deal with that next week. And then we'll move on to very strange chapter, chapter 14. It was great to be back. great to have you all back. There's some couple of questions here. Why would the righteous believe the prophecies of their death, speaking against these false prophets? So I guess you just answered. Yeah. It was a very, very frightening time to live in. A very, very frightening time to live in. People are very, you know, superstitious, and people see people die, and these women had powers. Certainly some of these women had powers. We know from the story of Shaul, at the end of the book of first book of Shmuel, that Shaul went to Abalas. Oh, these women, some of these women had tremendous power. Abigail, from a kosher side, from Lahabdil, Abigail had this type of power, but it was all for good. But there are women that in the past have had this power, and it can be very dangerous and very frightening. And keep away from them at the fairgrounds, right? When they invite you in to read the tarot cards, don't get roped into that type of thing. You could end up with a ponytail. Larry Lowenthal. Anyway. It's been great to be back. We're ready, almost ready to start chapter 14, which is great. It's a great chapter, very peculiar, as is quite a lot of Yechezkel. But we'll enjoy it, and please God, we'll all enjoy it in good health. Kol tov to everybody. I'll see you next week, same time, same place. Great to be back, and I'll see you then. Kol tov to everybody.